February 2nd, Wednesday. We are in day two of looking at tax compliance and collections processes. Yesterday we had the director of the Department of Revenue, Elizabeth Harshenko, and Susan Browning to do, the deputy director, to do a good overview of the governor's proposals for this session in terms of compliance and collections, and then kind of a state of the department. Today we're going to move into a more proactive, formal look at some proposals, starting with Paul and Deborah Buchanan from the department, really giving us a survey of what's going on in other states and some possibilities that Oregon might want to consider for this committee for tomorrow as we start looking at a bill. And then we're going to hear from a couple members of the legislature on proposals they have around collections and abuse of tax shelters and proposals they have. And then, Paul, after that, I think we go into any public... Oh, well, the panel from Tax Fairness that we'll hear from. Mm-hmm. And then we'll have any public testimony that folks want. And Senator George might also have someone to testify today, too. Then tomorrow what we'll do is we'll start looking at, we have a committee bill that we could use as a vehicle to start adding different components of what we've heard on yesterday and then Wednesday today in terms of marking up the bill. Paul, anything to add before we...
Well, Mr. Chair, I had a few things in your material to just highlight a couple things with you, and then turn it over to Deborah, who's been working with the department, particularly with the initiative that Director Harshenko talked about yesterday. But the three things I wanted to talk about in your packet, the first one is what I printed off from the California Franchise Tax Board. It's labeled Abusive Tax Shelters and Transactions, Frequently Asked Questions. And the second one is a similar printout. It's California Tax Amnesty, and California's amnesty program started yesterday. So they're in that and through next month, so we can take a look at the particulars of that. And then the last piece is just kind of a summary that the Federation of Tax Administrators keeps track of. It's all state tax amnesty programs going back to 1982. And you can see on that there's a pretty extensive list of states that have had amnesty programs, and Oregon is actually one of the few who has not had a formal amnesty program, as Elizabeth said yesterday. But just to highlight a few things, starting with the abusive tax shelters, it's a term I think that's thrown around a fair amount lately, but it's helpful probably to look at what the precise definition of it is. And if you see there on the bottom of page one, the definition is it's an abusive tax scheme that has no business purpose other than reducing taxes. So from an economist standpoint, it's something, a transaction or an organization, a corporation that would not exist if it were not for the tax system. So in that sense, it's clearly different than a tax expenditure where we may subsidize or favor certain kinds of activity that would have taken place anyway, but we want to encourage more of it. These are transactions that exist simply to avoid taxes. Hmm. So they have no economic rationale. And talks about how these abusive tax shelters, the forms they tend to take the forms of something that has a large constant stream of income. So you're trying to protect the stream of income through some mechanism to protect it from the tax consequences. You can also see on page two kind of the why have these suddenly emerged as an issue for states. Well, states have always been trying to find a way to tax particularly multinational operations, whether they be corporations or individuals with investments. But in the 90s, there was a pretty significant growth in this area. Certainly the large capital gains in the 90s are part of the reason for that. People had a lot of income they wanted to protect. from taxes. Also remember, and you know, if you go back to the late 90s, mid to late 90s, remember the real grilling that the IRS got before Congress for a couple of years. There was a lot of pressure on the IRS to be more friendly, more taxpayer friendly, more oriented toward less enforcement oriented, and their budgets were reduced, and some people and their actual auditing rates dropped during this period. The percentage chance of being audited declined. So the IRS backed off a bit in some compliance activity, and that may have been a factor. The other thing is there's been aggressive promotion of these these schemes, and you know there's an ish there, and that's been something that has been pushed by some of the accounting firms nationally and others as a way to avoid taxes. So those are some of the main reasons for the growth. You can see California has estimated that their abusive tax schemes have generated, estimated they've lost $2.4 to $4 billion in tax revenue over 4 years. So a significant amount of loss for California.
Paul, do you know offhand of any example of one of these schemes, for a lack of a better word? I remember seeing some media reporting on them a while back, but did any come to mind? I know we're going to have testimony in 15, 20 mm-hmm. minutes about this issue.
In terms of in case of Oregon or for the California example?
California, any
specific example? Do you know someone, Deborah?
If not, you know, I think we will. I think we'll get this in perhaps 15 minutes. So.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. One of the examples that I ran across in the research was a person with very large capital gains wants to reduce that, so they set up a partnership and transfer U.S. Treasury securities so that it creates basis in a partnership. Then there's a sale at a loss that offsets the gain, and so you have these pass-through entities that are set up and transactions that go on between those that don't really have an economic substance. That's one example, but I do have some material that can give you other examples as well.
Great, and we'll get into this. I mean, I know this is a big topic of discussion today, so thank you, Paul. I kind of jumped in on you.
Okay, no problem, Mr. Chair. Other things I just wanted to highlight is that they comment on 380 taxpayers that have been identified as investing in these abusive tax schemes in their 2004 program. But one of the things to keep in mind is they say that these 380 cases have potential revenue of $1 billion, but this revenue would not be collected over several years because of an appeal process, and that's something they're still in now. So Deborah and I have talked about this, and be interesting to see what ultimately their net revenue is, because there is an incentive here if you've done something questionable to come forward in order to protect yourself and then say, but I don't really think it is abusive, and then challenge it through an appeal process. So we'll see what percentage of that $1 billion is actually reduced when this is all said and done. There's a list of things that the Franchise Tax Board is doing to try to combat the issue. And I would just highlight number five there under their compliance strategies is to work with the legislature to create new tools. And so this comes into obvious direction for the committee when you start to think in terms of developing some actual legislation. And the things that they've identified in California in their program that would be something that would require legislation is they have enlisted there a voluntary compliance initiative, which they actually carried out in 2004 that generated the $1 billion. Stiffer penalties that they enacted on these marketing of these tax avoidance transactions. And the other thing that they emphasized was the need to go back further in time to issue these deficiencies, so to go beyond the current statute of limitations and allow the Department of Revenue to assess a deficiency that would go back, in their case, 8 years here is their suggestion. Mm-hmm. So that would be another thing that would require legislative action. So that gives you kind of the core, really, the legislative core of what the VCI was in California. The rest of this is a discussion about close links with the Internal Revenue Service, and it is important to note the IRS really initiated this through their 2003 program that was looking at offshore tax avoidance schemes, and that's where California built on that and has worked very closely. You may also notice that the Franchise Tax Board emphasized that they're working with other states. They have 34 other participating states in their memorandum of agreement to share information, and Elizabeth talked about that, particularly the big states with the resources and the bigger IRS have that ability and the resources to at least set the path, and they're working cooperatively with the states, the smaller states.
Question on that. Paul, do you think that, you know, on the setting of the path, that enough work has been done in this arena, both nationally and then in the large states like California and New York, that a medium-sized state like Oregon, with the resources we have at the department, is this something that enough groundwork has been done in terms of these shelters or schemes that we could follow suit and have a good path to do it?
Well, I think, Mr. Chair, that each state is different, unique, and we need to look at it from the Oregon perspective. But we're in a much better shape than if we were just starting on this path on our own without any kind of experience or the kind of information we have. So given the information we've got, I think it's something that is well worth the committee's time to look at and to pursue and see and look in detail about some of these particular elements and see how well they would fit in Oregon's case. And, you know, I think Elizabeth did a good job yesterday, too, saying that, you know, Oregon's system is unique. I mean, we do have some really unique features, the obvious one being the income tax dependence we have. Mm-hmm. You know, California, now in case of their amnesty program, they have a whole separate unit working on the sales tax. So, so we've got a little different perspective, but I think a lot of this experience seems to me, anyway, at this stage, would have a lot of relevance for Oregon. I'll just say a few things in terms of the tax amnesty program there, and that's that second page, a second printout. And these are all on the California Franchise Tax Board website, so if your staff want to pursue this a little bit more. As I said, the program began yesterday. It runs through March 31st. And, of course, one of the important things to look at is who's going to be eligible for it, and they're looking at through tax years 2002. They're looking at imposing additional penalties once this period is completed. One of the things that is important for individual taxpayers, and I've also looked at some things in terms of CPAs from a client advising position, saying, well, you have to look at the downside of this too. And one of the downsides of this is that you may submit a claim for a refund or credit, but once that's, or you may apply for the amnesty, but once you've done that, you may not submit a claim for a refund or credit. So you've kind of, once you've gotten into the system and said, you committed yourself to the amnesty program, you can't turn around and say, well, I was wrong, and it's really a refund or credit against other taxes. So
could you, I'm just not tracking that, Paul. If someone files for the amnesty because they believe they have not paid their taxes timely, then they realize that actually they weren't in noncompliance and they shouldn't be getting a refund, they're not able to do it? Is that what I'm hearing?
Senator Pozanski, it's, if after you've completed the amnesty, and you've got your fees and penalties waived. So, in essence, you've gotten your benefit. You've paid your taxes on that. You can't turn around and then come back and challenge that.
Okay, challenge it. Okay.
And say that, gee, I really should get that refunded because it wasn't. I didn't mean to do it, or I found out later that I didn't really need to do it, kind of thing. In terms of the program itself, the individuals who participate in the program have to have their application in by March 31st. And then the other thing that, again, something that was talked about yesterday that the Department of Revenue talked about is you then, to get you into the system, if you're a non-filer and haven't filed for previous years, then you, in order to maintain your amnesty and continue to get your benefits of no penalties or interest, you must remain in compliance by filing and paying taxes in 2005 and 2006. So that's another carrot to stay in the system and continue to participate. One of the things that we have discussed in terms of an amnesty program for income taxes in particular versus sales taxes, you can see that last sentence under number five. They're very upfront that California has a tax information exchange agreement with the IRS. What you disclose under tax amnesty will be available to them. So this is an issue in terms of an incentive to participate in the amnesty program, that if you haven't filed at the state level and you haven't filed at the federal level, then you step in and file for amnesty in California, that information will go to the IRS.
Do we have a similar requirement that we share all information, or would it be our option to have that same where we pass on the individual or company's name to the IRS?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that we do share the information with the IRS when we perform an audit. We will send that on, and it works in the reverse, too. We receive information from the IRS about the audits they've done.
Oh, okay.
Moving on there to eligibility, and number eight there talks about who they're looking for. They're looking for people who did not file California tax return, people who underreported income on a return that's already been filed, so they have some capital gain or some income that has not been reported. They claimed excessive deductions. Usually that means you would have claimed excessive federal deductions too. And did not pay previously assessed taxes, interest, penalty, or fees. So, you know, what that means is that if you've got people, and our Department of Revenue, as they describe, is a long list of people who they know, they've identified, who they're working with, that are not paid up on their taxes. Under the California-type program, those people, even though they've been identified, would be eligible for amnesty. So what that does is, you know, there's been quite a debate among the states about kind of the scoring. You know, how do you score? And you see these numbers in terms of this sheet of other states, and they have a column of how much was raised. Well, that's very much influenced by the parameters put around the program. So if you allow the people that you already know about to come in and claim amnesty, you're going to make these numbers look better.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you can raise the issue, since we already know about them, aren't we going to get them anyway,
mm-hmm.
kind of thing. So Deborah may want to comment on that, but it does certainly influence the numbers that show up in terms of what's been raised through the program.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that's important, and it's not clear to me, there may be some areas where this could discourage some applicants for amnesty, is that those who are not eligible are those who have abusive tax shelter transactions that were eligible under the VCI last year. So you could have a gray area there where you're not sure whether it is or not, and that would be a disincentive that you may come forward and say, I want to participate in the amnesty program, and the Franchise Tax Board says, no, this is really an abusive tax shelter. You should have applied last year.
Hmm.
So, and then you would be disallowed, and of course you would have already come forward. So,
but for a state that hasn't formalized any program in these two arenas, mm-hmm. you can structure a program to, I guess, account for both mm-hmm. both cases.
That's correct, Chair. Okay. Yes. Mm-hmm. So the rest of this goes in talking about the other elements of application. And there is a real incentive for people once they've, you know, you have to create an incentive for that time element, and they say, well, if you haven't applied by March 31st, then You can't apply for an extension for the amnesty. You have to be in the program. If you can't make the payments by the end of May under this program, then you can file for an installment program, and they would put you on that installment program. So they do give you some flexibility in terms of when you pay. So we'll see over the next couple of months the revenue that California raises and through the program. I know it'll be looked at closely, but as you can see from our handout on the states, we've got a lot of states that have had amnesty programs in the past. They tend to revolve around periods of fiscal difficulty, such as the early 80s. There was a series of them at that time. And then we've seen kind of a reemergence of them in recent years, again, associated with the fiscal problems the states have had from the 01 recession.
There's one on here that is intangibles from Florida. That seems, I mean, we obviously have the same, every state has intangible issues, but...
Mr. Chair, Florida has a unique intangibles tax. It's based on intangibles as in financial assets. And there is some a particular amount of tax that's assessed based on those. It's a form of a wealth tax. It's a financial wealth tax in which they collect at a fairly low rate, but they do collect a fair amount of revenue on it. And that's what that refers to. It is unique. We've done... I'm not sure if we have in our current tax package, but in the past we've tried to estimate what that would be for Oregon. We've had questions on that over the years, but it is a tax unique to Florida.
So, Paul, that was a huge test, and how Paul knew the Florida tax code and the intangible taxes in Florida is a credit to our legislative revenue officer.
I think that would be a good idea for a Senate road trip, Mr.
Yes.
Chair. Look at the intangible tax.
About this time.
Yeah, about Sunday we got a big...
So with that, I'll turn it over to Deborah, who's done a lot of work and with California experience and has a lot of material on that.
Great. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, again, for the record, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. You have a handout that reproduces some of the slides from a PowerPoint presentation the California Franchise Tax Board did last year, and I'd just like to hit some highlights of that. Also in that packet, there are three other areas. One deals with DOR efforts under current law, what we've been doing around the tax shelter area. There is an amnesty overview as well, and then the last section is just some information from a website. So from these slides, you have on page one some estimates of the revenue losses, and Paul has talked about that. On page two of the handout, you have a graph showing the individual and corporate tax revenues in California for various years, just to give you a perspective of the size of their revenue stream as compared to Oregon's. And quite a bit more, as you might note. Then on to page four of the handout. These are some of the changes that were resulting from the legislation in California that you may want to consider if you go this direction for Oregon. One of the things was that it was very important for them to enhance the penalty structure for people engaging in tax shelter activity after this window of opportunity to come forward. They did that through both investor penalties and also promoter penalties. The investor penalties are listed there at the bottom of page four. You can see that before this legislation, they had few or no penalties applying to investors and significant penalties that apply after that. And the same thing applies to promoters of the shelters. So those that are required to register the shelters or to disclose the information, or they're a material participant and they don't follow the law, then these penalties can be applied.
So what is the enforcement mechanism on finding the promoters? I mean, you'll see sometimes little advertisements here and there. Is it the Department of Revenue in California, or did Governor Schwarzenegger create a new body to be the enforcement mechanism?
Mr. Chair, I believe that they actually did set up a separate unit in California that's dealing with tracking down tax shelters and promoters and making sure that they're complying with the requirements. Mm. I can confirm that for you and make sure that that's correct.
It would be interesting, yeah, to know.
At the bottom of page 5, Paul already mentioned the doubling of the statute of limitations to 8 years in California. Their normal statute of limitations for making adjustments is 4 years. That's been expanded to 8 years to give them a period of time to look at those shelters that were very active in the early 2001-2002 time period. Some more information on the VCI on page 6, $1.3 billion in tax revenue that came in during this 106-day period, 1,200 taxpayers, 2,100 tax years. If you look at page 7, this was interesting to me to see where the money was coming from in this because it was just almost opposite of what I had thought it would be. It's individual taxpayers accounted for and pass-through entities accounted for more than 50% of the total revenue. Corporations were actually very small in that. By taxpayer, again, 796 personal income taxpayers, 103 pass-through, and 287 corporations that were reporting. Paul mentioned the appeal option. California had two options. One was to simply pay the tax and interest and not retain any right to appeal. This is at the top of page 8. Option 2 was to pay the tax and interest but retain the right to appeal. But if you did that, you were also subject to an accuracy-related penalty if you were determined to be incorrect. And I inserted a slide here. You can see a press release from Cathay Bank indicating that this is what they did. They paid the state taxes and the interest, but they retained the right to appeal, and now they have a $12 million receivable on their books for 3 years of taxes that they have paid to California that they may eventually get back if this goes through the court system and they prevail. So only 25%, according to this, of the revenue that came into California would they be able to count as free and clear revenue.
The rest
of it is either they have a right to file a claim, it's pending federal action, or they have actually filed a claim for refund. They paid the taxes and filed a claim for refund. So in looking at those dollars that have come in, it's important to keep in mind what they're actually going to be able to keep versus what might go out in refunds later.
So I don't understand that. So they complied. I mean, or they came in either under the VCI, the Voluntary Compliance Initiative, or under this abusive tax shelter, which was obviously the world's changed. And so they send in, say, $1 million, that was what was deemed owed. But then immediately after putting in $1 million, file an appeal to say, we're paying, but we don't feel that the million that was owed was correct, so therefore we're going to credit it back to our books in terms of our account receivable.
Well, Mr. Chair, this is it's a complicated and gray area as to what is an abusive tax shelter and what is not. And some of the transactions that companies engage in are actual legitimate transactions that fit within the limitations of the code. So if a company believes that it's on the edge, it may want to take advantage of this, make the payment, keep the appeal rights, and what they're risking is an accuracy-related penalty if they lose.
I see. But therefore, all the penalties have been waived at that point, so at least that they have pay the, in this case, $1 million, but at least then the penalties are gone, and they can just have their appeals adjudicated in whatever decisions.
The other penalties are gone. If the company did not take advantage of this and just stayed out there and eventually they were caught by the Franchise Tax Board and found to be engaging in abusive tax shelters, they would be subject to not just the accuracy-related penalty, but other penalties.
Mm-hmm.
Failure to register, failure to disclose, substantial understatement of income, and so on and so on. So this gets them out of the potential of being subject to those penalties by coming in, paying the tax and the interest, but keeping their appeal rights so they can still argue their case in the court.
I see.
Okay. At the top of page 9, there is information about how much came in per year, and you can see that by tax year, that is, 2000, a lot of income, a lot of incentive to shelter the income. So, and again, it's important here to point out the statute of limitations that would apply for 1999, for example. This return was required to be filed for a calendar taxpayer by April of 2000, and the statute of limitations for California would expire in April of 2004. For Oregon, it would have expired April of 2003. So that's another important point. And then just some of the activities that that they engaged in to publicize this program. I don't have a lot of information on that. If you're interested in it, I can do some research. Another thing that helped in California was what was going on at the federal level at this time. They really didn't have to try to push this through their legislature as much as they might have otherwise because of what was going on at Congress. And you might recall at that time they were having hearings in the SPSI, actually is an acronym for the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. They were holding hearings on KPMG activities and what they had done as far as promoting tax shelters and so on, and had an extensive investigation of what KPMG was doing. They studied 4 programs there, and the SC2 is an example of one that might be fairly simple to understand. This is an S Corporation charitable contribution strategy. What's happening with that one is an S Corporation sets up a nonprofit entity, issues non-voting stock, and then allocates income over to that nonprofit to get it out of the S Corporation income stream. They don't actually have to give them the money, they just allocate the income. So that's a one that KPMG was promoting heavily.
But that would be clearly illegal, I would think.
Mr. Chairman, that gets back to the definition of what is a tax shelter, and Paul talked about it at the very beginning. There is a definition. I'll just read this for you. A tax-motivated transaction unrelated to a taxpayer's normal business operations that under a literal reading of some relevant legal authority produces a loss for tax purposes in excess of any economic loss in a manner inconsistent with legislative intent or purpose. So what they're doing is they're looking at the words in the code and structuring deals that meet the literal words in the code but don't reflect legislative intent. And it takes some very bright minds, a lot of them, to do this, but that's what they have done. And it's...
So it's statute, so it's something under our purview that if we need to better express legislative intent...
Well, again, Mr. Chair, these are federal rules. So what they're doing are they're looking for the loopholes, the areas where you can do it this way and save yourself some money when you look at just the words in the statute and not the intent and not the context. That's what the promoters are selling. Another example, a very simple one, and I know I'm running out of time here, but for individuals, the federal law allows you to claim an expense for traveling from one work location to another work location. If I'm a contractor, for example, and I'm working on the convention center downtown, I drive to the convention center, I do my work in the morning, and I have another job location that I need to go to in the afternoon. The cost of driving from the first job site to the second job site is deductible. So one thing that promoters have sold to individuals is set up a home office. Go in there in the morning for 15 minutes and do your work, and you are at work, and then you drive to your other office, and you have a deductible expense. I mean, that's just a very simple one. It doesn't arise to the $15 million capital gains sheltering, but that's an example of what would be an abusive tax shelter under federal rules. Very, very simple. So, again, it's using a literal reading of the law to shelter the income. That's all I had on the VCI. And then as far as what Oregon is doing, I'll just go through this very briefly. We have received information from California about corporations that engaged in abusive tax shelters and then filed with California to report that. We have 58 returns currently in the audit process, and we will be asking them about the California returns that they filed. Some have indicated they will file amended returns with us. Some would like that to be part of the audit. Another 85 corporate returns were also filed with Oregon, and we're writing them to ask them to make similar adjustments to the Oregon return as to what they did for the California return. If we were to take those deductions or the ATAT deductions that they reported to California and just extrapolate to Oregon, it would amount to $5 million in tax due to Oregon from those corporations. Now, admittedly, that is not likely to be the exact answer because they may have credits they didn't use and so on, but that's just an example. And then we're doing research on the other returns. As far as individuals and what we've received from them, you can see on page 14 some information about what California has reported, quite a bit less, but we still have some work to do there. Some issues that you might want to consider if you choose to do one of these programs for Oregon is that our current statute of limitations would not allow us to go back to some of those years, 99, 2000, and so forth. We have just a general three-year statute unless there's a substantial understatement of income. So that might be one thing to consider. We don't have a lot of penalties that apply to tax shelter promoters. In fact, I don't think we have any penalties specifically for promoters. We do have penalties, and I believe I included a sheet on page, yes, at the back of page 17, listing out some penalties that we do have under current law. But that might be one thing to consider is whether you want to enhance penalties if you do this. We also may have some issues around disclosure of confidential information. As I mentioned, we receive information from the IRS, and when we get that information, we can use that to make audit adjustments. So, Mr. Chairman, this goes back to your question about whether the groundwork has been laid already and whether we really need to do a whole lot. You have given us authority in statute to make adjustments to returns when we receive information from the IRS, and we do get this information. We will get it. And once we receive that, we can make adjustments based on that. We have a two-year period to do that, even though the statute of limitations has run. So if the IRS 5 years from now sends us information about an adjustment on a return, we could use that to adjust the Oregon return.
So now, I mean, we came across the California issue of the 8 year, and I marked that down as something that we ought to look at in terms of our own statutory. Is that something that the department feels needs to be adjusted to give you at least some more latitude to look at a longer period of time for an individual or for a company that you could look at when auditing?
Mr. Chairman, if we were to do these audits independently of the IRS, if we were initiating them, in order to go back more than 3 years, we would need a change to the statute of limitations. If we're receiving information from the IRS about audits they have done, current law gives us 2 years, no matter when we get that information.
So it seems to me, I mean, that you would need more than 3 years.
That's a possibility. The other area is that if we receive information from California, we don't have an additional period of time.
Okay.
So that might need an exception.
Okay.
And then on page 15, Mr. Chair, there is a bit of information about amnesty. I don't know whether you want me to talk about that or not. Paul talked already about how you structure an amnesty, whether you simply have non-filers in the system, whether you're looking at people that we already know about that may be on a payment plan or making payments now, whether you want to include those. We were looking at possibly a legislative concept dealing with abusive tax avoidance transactions during our legislative concept development process, and we simply ran out of time to try to craft a bill. The Multi-State Tax Commission, I believe, is working on language for states, uniform language that is using California as the model, and that might be coming out fairly soon. And then again, following the penalty spreadsheet is a chronology of what has happened at the federal level along with some websites that can give you more information, more detail about different shelters.
Did you want to say anything about amnesty briefly, and then we'll get to Representative Pearson?
Very briefly, Mr. Chair, we do feel that we have somewhat of an amnesty program already, an informal one that we can use on a case-by-case basis through the penalty waiver process. We talked yesterday about having penalties for taxpayers that file more than 3 years' worth of returns late, a 100% penalty for that. We have tried to use the penalty waiver as an incentive for those taxpayers to come into the system to file their returns and get straight with us. So we do use the penalty waiver provisions as somewhat of a mini amnesty, if you will. Other states' experiences, Paul talked about the revenue and what you might see there. We have not actually tried to do a formal estimate of what amnesty might bring in. We do have voluntary disclosure agreements now that allow corporations to come and contact us and say, well, we think we might be subject to tax in your state. We would like to file returns for the last X years and get back into the system and get current with our filings, so we can work with them to make sure that that's done. Elizabeth talked about the Multi-State Tax Commission and the Nexus program where they work with companies as well to make sure that they come in. So again, things that you would want to consider in an amnesty program is, are you simply accelerating money to this time period that would be collected anyway? What does it do to people who are filing and paying correctly? What kind of a message does that send to them as to why should I pay if you're just going to turn around and let them off the hook when they don't? So you want to be conscious of that. That's sometimes not a real good message. And then again, talking about the accounts receivable amnesty and whether or not you include that in the amnesty.
Thank you, Ms. Buchanan. We really appreciate any other questions for Ms. Buchanan. Just one in terms of, I know President Bush allocated several hundred million dollars last year towards the tax shelter on the federal level. Do you know if there's anything? It's pretty early to deem if anything's come of that, but does the department know if that's been helpful? It was a large allocation to the Department of Treasury.
Mr. Chairman, I can get you that information. There is, on the IRS website, they have information about their activities and what they have done as far as the tax shelters are concerned and contacts and results, and I'm happy to get you a printout of that or send you a link to that.
We can certainly look into
we'll do that.
Other questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Y'all have been extremely helpful in kind of setting the foundation for us as we start looking now at proposals, and would want to work with the department as we start marking up
and
the bill.
We're more than happy to work with you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Greg McPherson from Lake Oswego, Southwest Portland.
That's
Burlingame.
That is my district, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Deckert. For the record, again, I'm Greg McPherson, House District 38, and I am here to describe an assortment of ideas for improving compliance with Oregon income tax. And you have a one-pager, I think, that's been distributed that just very briefly goes over these ideas, and I'm going to go over them in just a little more detail here. And because there are five different ideas, don't feel as though you need to wait till the end. If you have questions about particular ideas, jump right in. These were introduced in two bills on the House side this week, House Bills 2486 and 2487. So they are in the process at this point, although they've just been introduced. first of all, by way of background, I think the key to these proposals is fairness. That is, Oregonians who pay their taxes, and nearly all Oregonians do, mainly through wage withholding by their employers, they pay their taxes, and they get a portion back from excess withholding at the end of the year. But they're meeting their obligation to fund services in the state. But there are some individuals and some businesses that are avoiding paying their taxes, and that's not right. It's not fair to the people who are complying. So the thrust of this effort is to try to improve the compliance, some of the non-compliance being accidental. It's not necessarily intentional in all cases, but it's to improve compliance so that the people who are complying know that others are doing so as well. It is the hope that it will generate some additional revenue without it being a tax increase, because these ideas are simply policy changes about how we collect income tax. They don't in any way increase the tax burden. It's just to get people who are not paying what they owe to do so. There are five ideas here. The first and highest profile one is a crackdown on abusive tax shelters. And you've already heard some discussion about the tax shelter problem, and I'd like to share a perspective from my professional life. In my other life, I'm an attorney at a large law firm in Portland, and my area of practice is employee benefits, which is pension plans and other kinds of retirement plans and fringe benefit plans. And that area of practice does involve significant work with the Federal Internal Revenue Code and certain tax incentives that are given to employers and their employees to accumulate savings for retirement. Wherever there is a tax incentive given to get people to do something that's good social policy, there is also grows up certain practices that are at the margin or across the margin of what the border of what's permissible. And I have certainly seen that in my practice. It tends to be promoted by organizations that have as their main or a significant aspect of their business developing tax shelter ideas that then they bring around and present to high net worth individuals and to businesses. We see these in my practice at times because the more responsible of our clients will bring the ideas to us and say, okay, this was presented to us as a good idea. Does it work? And oftentimes our answer is no, it doesn't work, or probably doesn't work. But you know that for all the cases where a responsible client is bringing that proposal to their lawyer to review, there are probably any number of cases then where it's not being brought to their tax counsel for review. Just to give you an example of one that's been around for some years, I practice, as I said, in the retirement plan area, which a major vehicle, which is a 401k plan. And there's both an employer's tax year and there's a 401k plan year. Usually the two coincide. They usually both run on a calendar year. But there were promoters here over the past decade who have asserted that if an employer amends their plan year, the 401k plan, to shorten it by one day so that that plan year ends on December 30, and so it falls within the taxable year that ends the next day, that entitles them to deduct all the contributions that are made by employees on a salary reduction basis through the next several months of the next year, thereby accelerating dollars that would have been deductible in the following year and bringing it into the preceding year. Now you might say, well, it's just 1 year acceleration. What's the big deal? Well, it's worth millions of dollars to substantial employers to use a device like that. By the way, it doesn't work. The IRS has issued rulings that say it doesn't work. I think that particular gimmick isn't much around nowadays, but it gives you a flavor for the kind of things that are being done. There is an industry of organizations, and it involves, in some cases, the major national and international accounting firms that have a research and development staff whose whole job it is to dream these things up. In fact, the Arthur Andersen accounting firm that imploded in the wake of the Enron debacle was a significant player in this industry, for example. So we need to try to do our best to get at this area of activity. Wherever there is a lot of money riding on the result, you're never going to eliminate this activity. It's a kind of a constant process of sort of what I call a thrust and parry to try to pursue people who are intent on not paying the taxes they owe. The lead idea that's in a separate bill, it's HB 2486, is a crackdown on abusive tax shelters that's modeled on a program in California which increased the penalties on people who use tax shelters and on the people who promote tax shelters. It created new additional penalties on those categories of players. To give you a flavor for the amounts, it's an additional 20% or 40% of the tax that was owed that wasn't paid by the taxpayer, if it's shown to be a listed transaction, that is one that's identified by the IRS, or this bill would give authority to the Department of Revenue here in Oregon to identify other transactions that are listed transactions that are deemed to be abusive.
So, Representative McPherson, just on that, it seems to me that in this proposal and the ones we've seen in California and in President Bush's, the emphasis in this arena tends to be on better enforcement and penalties, which indicates to me that the laws are clear, are not in need of adjustment, and perhaps that's not correct, but more that the attention should be on just better penalty and enforcement of those existing laws to root out activities like the ones you...
Senator Deckert, that's quite right. The focus is on penalizing misconduct, which is using tax shelters that are identified as abusive and the people who promote them to the users. While we should always, in the way we design tax law, try to make that law as clear as possible so that we don't... we can administer it in a fair way where people are paying when they owe and are not paying when they don't owe, that is a very elusive goal because we're talking about very complicated matters. I mean, imagine that example I just described to you of a one-year difference in the plan year of a 401k plan. Well, who would have thought that that would make a difference, create an argument that it accelerates a deduction? There are an endless number of those, and an attempt to legislate specifically against particular tax shelters, it just chases the players away to some new arena. And it's been said that our federal income tax code is the candy store of American politics. It's got goodies for everybody in there. There are incentives to get them to do things that we want them to do. And as long as we not only have the basic challenge of trying to measure what is income, net income, but we also have incentives to people to do things that we want them to do because it reflects good social policy, like saving for retirement, for example. As long as we have a tax code that functions that way, we will have tax shelters. People, it's only limited by the imagination of the folks who are in this industry. So the bill that I had introduced would include an amnesty program for abusive tax shelters of a limited number of months, and it's drafted to be in early 2006, under which people who come forward voluntarily would not have to pay the additional penalties that are being imposed by the act, and so the success in terms of generating revenue would depend a lot on how effectively it was communicated to the and understood by the users and promoters who are potentially under sanction from it. I think you've heard some numbers about the results of California's program on abusive tax shelters, and they got some really startlingly large amounts in. I don't predict that we will do the same in proportion here in Oregon. I think that there are some peculiar reasons why California had an opportunity because they were dealing with the dot-com bubble, people who were making amazing capital gains and were availing themselves of all kinds of strategies to try to reduce their tax bill. We didn't have a strong counterpart to that here in Oregon, so I don't think that we're going to see the same kind of proportionate results. But I do think that this is the time to closely consider this program because the statute of limitations on the years at the end of the 1990s is about to run out under the standard 3 or 5 year statute of limitations that applies to Oregon income tax liabilities. And while I don't believe there's any constitutional reason why you can't reopen a statute of limitations, I think that psychologically it may be a much more difficult to extend our reach backward. And we did have significant capital gains that were occurring in Oregon in 1999 and 2000. Let me say, too, that while this proposal includes an amnesty program, on sort of general principles, I'm not a great fan of amnesty programs. I think there's the risk that you are bringing in or accelerating revenue you're going to get anyway, so it's like selling an asset to get more cash in hand because you feel pinched at the time, rather than letting it come in the normal flow. But in this instance, where we have an area of activity that has been pursued quite successfully by our neighbor to the south, it just seems like it makes sense to take a close look at this effort at this time to see whether we can do a counterpart here. We don't have to do all the spade work. We can model our program, and that's the way I had House Bill 2486 drafted, is to model it on the California program. I'll move on to these the other ideas, and I say they're not as high profile, but it's a collection of what I think are good ideas, policy changes that I think will improve tax compliance. The next idea is withholding on retirement payments. This is just one of those quirks in the law I'm familiar with because of my law practice. For federal income tax purposes, if a person receives a lump sum distribution from an employer-sponsored retirement plan and does not directly roll it over to an IRA, an individual retirement account, then that amount is subject to a mandatory 20% federal income tax withholding. So that's held out. It's sent to the IRS. And the person still can, by the way, roll it over to an IRA, but they have to advance the tax in effect with that withholding and then come in and claim a refund. Oregon income tax does not parallel the federal tax. It is elective withholding for those people, they who have a lump sum distributions from, say, an Oregon-based 401k plan. There is a pattern in which people will tend to make a change of scene when they retire. They finish a working career in Oregon, and they might decide they want to move to Washington State or Nevada or a Sun Belt state, maybe one that doesn't have an income tax. And if they haven't had the Oregon income tax withheld from that distribution, then it might be one of those things that kind of falls through the cracks. Maybe not so much intention to not pay a tax owed as sort of an ability to disregard it because of all the disruptions that are occurring when they're relocating and leaving a career. The second idea is also a withholding idea. It's withholding tax on the capital gain on sale of Oregon real estate by non-residents. There are a number of other states that have such a withholding provision, and Oregon does not. And the risk is that somebody who's out of state and is not otherwise filing an Oregon income tax return may not be aware that they owe Oregon income tax on the capital gain on that property that they sold, or may find it very easy to just not get around to filing the tax. This would apply a withholding rate of the lesser of 4% of the sale proceeds, or the net, 4% of the sale price or the net proceeds, whichever is less. So that money is in hand, then it's sent by the escrow company that handles the closing, sent to the Oregon Department of Revenue. If the person doesn't owe the tax, then they can claim a refund. It just means that we have the dollars here in Oregon, so that person who's out of state has to come and do a filing and demonstrate by filing a return that has some penalties of perjury if they make a fraudulent statement that they're not subject to tax.
Mayor George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to back up to the retirement issue.
Okay.
Last session had a person I know in the building who came to me and said that he was counseled by the PERS counselors, you know, the financial counselors, to strongly consider, because of the fact that both he and his wife had very high income potential coming out of their PERS retirement, to consider moving to another state that did not have the income tax. Will you be able to address that with this bill? Because apparently we were advising the people in the state to exploit that potential.
Chair Deckert, Senator George, unfortunately, the Congress has limited the ability of Oregon to tax retirement amounts that are earned here and received when a person has moved to another state. And so a distribution from the PERS system or any other what's called a tax-qualified retirement plan is not subject to Oregon income tax. We're not allowed to tax it. And that was a change in the tax law about 10 or 12 years ago, used to be subject to what's called a source tax. But the Congress decided that they didn't want states pursuing retirement distributions that had been earned in their state, even though received in another state. So our hands are tied in that respect, and so I'm imagining that the advice that was being given to that PERS retiree was sound advice, even though I may disagree with the federal policy that drove it.
Yep. Would you have any suggestion? I mean, do we offer a benefit that would say, you know, please spend the money here that was accumulated, you know, by the payments from the taxpayers of Oregon for your employment, spend it here? I mean, can you envision anything that might encourage them to stay here? Because obviously if they spend the money here, we're way better off than if they spend it in Washington State or Nevada or Texas.
Right. We actually have a sort of a dysfunction because we actually give people an incentive to leave.
Right.
Because you know, it used to be that PERS retirement distributions were not subject to Oregon income tax. And when that was repealed as a result of some litigation, there was a benefit increase that was applied to people who were in lieu of the tax exemption they used to have. That benefit increase is referred to as the House Bill 3349 increase. And it applies across the board to any PERS retirement benefit calculation. And that benefit continues even as the person moves out of state. So it's not that we haven't created a disincentive. In fact, we've in some sense created an incentive. The fourth idea here is state collection of local income taxes. We don't have many local income taxes in Oregon, but we have had recent experience in Multnomah County, which is part of my legislative district. And there was a great difficulty with noncompliance in that collection of that tax because it wasn't done through the Oregon Department of Revenue. It wasn't based on the same measure of taxable income. And whenever there has to be a separate calculation of the tax and an affirmative action taken by the taxpayer to pay it, there is just naturally going to be, you know, poor compliance, level of compliance. This is to set up a system that is not required. Local governments could still decide to go it on their own. But if they chose to use the same definition of taxable income as Oregon uses and to base the liability for that tax on place of residence, that is residing within, say, a city or a county that has that taxing authority, then they, based on a request from that jurisdiction to the Department of Revenue, the department would be obligated then to collect that tax. And the collection of it shouldn't be very difficult, because it would be adding one line item onto the Oregon Form 40, should, at least as I would imagine it would be done, because you calculate taxable income, and then it would be a line that would be labeled something like local income tax, and it would be a calculation that's a percentage of that underlying state tax or a percentage of the taxable income. So it's queued up so that it would be a high efficiency thing to do and wouldn't experience the very high level of noncompliance that has been reported out of Multnomah County. Now, this isn't designed to dovetail with just what Multnomah County did, and in fact, this caps the total amount of local taxes that would be collected in this way at 1% of taxable income, whereas the Multnomah County tax was 1.25%. And it's designed to do that because making it not burdensome to the Department of Revenue to do, I think, depends in part on it being an add-on, something that's within the general order of magnitude of the numbers that are underlying on the return. And I think if we had people go shooting at several percentage points, it would change the work that's involved in handling this collection in a way that would be undesirable.
Representative McPherson, on that, and this one, this proposal is a little bit out of kind of the purview of what I think we're looking at in terms of the narrow focus on just the state issues, although there's certainly a compliance angle to it.
Yeah.
But I guess how would you answer the concern that if the state did move this, and again, I would say this probably is not in the purview of what we're looking at today, but if we did move forward on this one, the fourth proposal on the list, in some ways we are codifying a very decentralized tax structure in Oregon that we've seen in the last 5 years become more decentralized, from meals taxes in Ashland to utility taxes in Springfield to
a sales tax referenda in Ontario to the income tax in Multnomah County, and in some ways the state is not only codifying by making the collections process much more efficient, I would agree, and simpler, but also locking into place a tax structure that one could easily argue is not good for economic development. It gives, because of the patchwork of taxes that you're going to see rise up. So that would be, I guess, a concern that I would have with the fourth proposal, though.
If I could respond to that, Chair Deckert, members of the committee, bear in mind that this doesn't create any taxing authority that does not already exist. And, in fact, it limits the mechanism for collection so that it really it's just a 1% increment. So in that sense, I think it may actually pull the other direction, because while it creates a mechanism for that facilitates a local tax, it also caps the amount so that we're not going to see under this proposal, you know, a 2 or 3 percentage point kind of local tax. And in that sense, I think this may actually push the other direction, because it will discipline local governments when they're thinking about what they're going to do. They're going to see that 1% is the limit, and that's an aggregate limit for all overlapping jurisdictions that have income taxing authority. So no Oregon resident would pay more than 1% of their taxable income under this provision. I would say whether or not we create taxing authority that doesn't now exist at the local government level is a debate for another vehicle. This is just saying, if we're going to do it, and we have been doing it, let's do a good job of it. Then the last idea is to authorize state agencies that issue occupational and professional licenses to require applicants for issuance or renewal of a license to confirm that they're in compliance with the income tax laws, and it would thereby create authority to pull somebody's license if they were not in compliance, so that there's an extra sanction that if they're coming to the state to seek the opportunity to engage in an activity that generates income, then they ought to make sure they're paying the tax that's owed on that income. There is an existing statute that covers some of the same ground, but procedurally, from the input that I got from the Department of Revenue when I was developing these ideas last year, that this looked like it was a better version of that concept. So that's why I included it within this list, because I think it's one of those tools that ought to be in the toolbox.
And do you know, do other states require similar swearings or...
Senator Deckert, I don't have the answer to that. I don't know to what extent that's a widespread practice. So just in conclusion, Chair Deckert, members of the committee, this is an accumulation of five policy ideas that are not a tax increase. It's opportunities to do a better job of achieving income tax compliance in Oregon. There are bound to be other good ideas as well. These have been introduced over in the House side, but I have no great pride of authorship here. I think these are ideas that are deserving of consideration, and if you chose to include them in a vehicle that you were moving through the process, I would be pleased to advocate for that vehicle. But I think that it's time that we held out to the people of Oregon better assurance that they're not the only ones paying what they owe. And I think that's the bottom line.
Thank you. And thank you for the great work and the time that I'm sure you put in over last summer in working on these. Questions for Representative McPherson? Well, someone has to ask him about Florida intangibles.
I better dodge quickly. Thank you, Chair Deckert, members of the committee.
Thanks.
Thank you. Next, we have a panel from Jody Weiser. Do you have a panel? I have four people here, and I'm not sure if that is your panel or not. Or five.
Thank you.
Thank you for inviting us to come. This group, Tax Fairness Oregon, has been, since the beginning of 2004, examining what's happening with tax enforcement in the state and seeing it as a possible source to deal with some, both our revenue issues and the whole integrity of the tax system issues.
And we just have to get your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Jody Weiser. I'm from Portland, Oregon, and I'm chair of Tax Fairness Oregon. With me?
It's Dale Devick. I'm a resident of Salem. And my name is Dale Devick, spelled D-I-E-V-I-G. I'm a former IRS agent, revenue agent, and I retired to Oregon with a higher tax rate than California.
Welcome.
And you know where the bones are buried, so we're glad you came to Oregon, I think.
We come to you today concerned that Oregon needs to increase its efforts to collect taxes for four reasons: revenue, the integrity of the voluntary tax system, an enforcement gap, and an opportunity gap. One, revenue. Making the cuts you face today will be painful, just as it was last session. The solution we suggest will not be immediate, and it will not solve all the problems. But it will address some of the revenue needs. And they will certainly more than pay for themselves. In general, state revenue departments generate an 8-to-1 to 10-to-1 return on investment. That figure was cited to us by Richard Tsunamoto of the Department of Revenue when he was speaking with our group, and he's head of one of their compliance divisions. And it was also quoted to me by a number of tax administrators from around the country. The IRS is no longer the audit and collection arm it once was, and our state's audit and collection resources have not grown to take up the slack as our population has grown and as the complexity of taxation has grown. So today in Oregon, the best form of tax reform is increased tax compliance. Second, there's the integrity of the voluntary tax system. You'll hear in a few minutes that we estimate that the tax gap in Oregon to be $1 billion a year. Now, not all of that will be collectible, but if we do not act, tax avoidance will continue to spread. An IRS survey was conducted in 1999 and again in 2003. In 1999, 81% of the taxpayers said, no, 87% of the taxpayers said it's not acceptable to cheat. This is what they would say out loud to an interviewer, what is necessarily a statement about their own behavior. 4 years later, the percentage had increased. You know, cheating was much more acceptable. That's a very rapid change in social mores around tax compliance. But taxes are the dues of citizenship, and tax enforcement is the obligation of government. Three, we have an enforcement gap. Since 1996 in the Roth hearings in the IRS, there are a third fewer IRS staff than 8 years ago, and there are one-third fewer IRS audits than 15 years ago. But there are more returns to examine and far more pass-through entities. So very much less is actually seen by the human eye. Only 7 out of 1,000 corporations has faced a face-to-face audit with IRS examiners in 2003. It was a 15 to 1,000 ratio 5 years earlier. And the Department of Revenue, while you have continued to fund at a rather even level, has not been able to pick up the gap, because when you lose a hunk of IRS agents from the state of Oregon, you're not going to be doing the compliance work unless you fill that gap at the state level. The problem is being noticed at the national level. The president has asked for increased funding, particularly to deal with abusive tax shelters and high net worth individuals. However, the Congress has not seen fit to pass those additions into the budget. So what's happening is a shift of resources from one area to another area rather than a real increase in the resources at the federal level. Four, we have an opportunity gap. Non-matchable income is on the rise. Much of the economy, and therefore individuals' reported income, is not verifiable or matchable by tax authorities without a physical audit, but audits are on the decline. The tax system is very good at taxing wage earners, verifies income from salary, bank and investment interests and dividends, Social Security, pensions, government refunds. They're all independently reported to the government and taxed. As a result, most tax evasion is by investors, business owners, landlords, business and investment partnerships, corporations, S-corps, LLCs, and that new class of income earners, contract workers, many of whom receive no 1099s or other sources of independent verification. When April 15th arrives, some taxpayers don't have the cash at hand, never got into the habit of making estimated payments, and have no experience with filing these kinds of tax forms, and they simply fall out of the system as a consequence. I want to use myself and my sons as examples because I think we need to see how real it is. Last year, I had $78,000 worth of taxable income. Only $29,000 of that was verifiable by taxing authorities. The rest, 63% of my income, I paid taxes on because I voluntarily reported that income. If I hadn't, there would be no reason for me to be audited, save that my charitable contributions are outside the norm. And so I might get picked up for, you know, being outside the norm on charitable contributions. The fact that I had investment losses to show is a place where it's very much up to the taxpayer to say, what did this asset cost me? So I could sell. I have paperwork submitted to the IRS and the Department of Revenue as a consequence that says I sold an asset for a certain amount of money. But it's really up to my honesty to say whether that was a profit or a loss, because I can create the basis in it I want, and if I'm not audited, it goes unwatched. I haven't been audited, however, since 1969. Last year, one son's family earnings were nearly all documented with matchable W-2s and 1099s. They can't do much tax avoiding, except by exaggerating her teaching expenses and his business expenses and their contributions. They have no choice to be tax compliant. But my other son's family earnings are nearly all undocumented. Theirs is non-matchable income. He recently remarked that his wife was probably the only food server in town who declared every penny of her tips. Their compliance is voluntary. What supports the continuance of that behavior? In the past, no apparent attention was paid when my income placed me in the top 5% with ample opportunity for fudging on my returns. Most of my income in those years was S-corp and partnership income. While K-1s were prepared and filed, the Department of Revenue and the IRS didn't then and still don't have the capacity to electronically match income and losses from those forms to the tax forms of the person who would be paying taxes on it. So if I, for instance, had not declared that I had $160,000 worth of farming income, no one would have picked it up. I have been told that at the IRS, the two sets of forms don't even enter the same room. So I paid taxes when we had great farming years and when we sold the business, and it was entirely voluntary. The income from farming, from real estate and equipment sales, and from stock sales were not matched. Jumps in income didn't trigger an audit, but the $49 of interest on my checking account, now that was matched. Don't we need a cop on the corner? There are a number of different ideas that our group has, and I want to speak for a moment about abusive tax shelter ideas that Representative McPherson has brought forward. And then I'm going to ask Del to speak because he has worked on coming up with quantifying the tax gap in the state. First, we suggest that when you do an abusive tax shelter amnesty initiative, you increase the statute of limitations to 10 years. That gives the taxpayer knowledge that they're going to have to sit around with uncertainty for a long time. And it gives the Department of Revenue no pressure to act with great speed and put this kind of taxpayer ahead of other taxpayers in their audit line. We believe that you should build a targeted enforcement unit for these kinds of abuses. California started their tax initiative with about 20 people they pulled together from their current staff. Last year they had 42 people in that department, and this year they're increasing it to 60. They have another 200 cases that they have found that they intend to act on. So they've, you know, they're coming up with stuff continuously. As they were dealing with the first set of people who came forward during their amnesty period, they discovered that taxpayers in California were not only buying these abusive tax shelters, but they were also buying insurance against being audited for abusive tax shelters. And the Franchise Tax Board has now subpoenaed the records of those insurance companies and have asked not only for those people who bought that kind of insurance, but also the people who inquired about that kind of insurance so that they can go looking for where the taxpayers are. When South Carolina this summer did an abusive tax shelter amnesty, they did not establish a department. They had one person whose phone number was given to call. 22 taxpayers representatives did call. They stepped forward. They paid $8 million in taxes. Those taxpayers had paid, as far as he recalled, between $750 and $1 million for the tax advice that exempted, or that made them think they were not going to need to pay taxes on their income. And everyone that they caught in their system was already being investigated by the IRS. Whereas California, being much more assertive about what they were about, got only 25% of the people who came forward were already in contact with the IRS. So I think that the way the initiative is designed, the resources you put available to the department to work on it, are going to have a great deal to do with the outcomes. California's people, when I talked to them, said, look, we had the idea in March. We had the legislation passed in October. We started the voluntary compliance period the 1st of January. We talked hard and fast, and people came forward because they were afraid we were going to find them. What it felt like in South Carolina and talking to them was it's kind of like, well, let's see what we can do for these people. There were no penalties. All the penalties that the taxpayers would have been subject to were relieved, and 50% of their interest was relieved if they stepped forward. So basically, they got off really cheap by coming forward during their amnesty period. We think that you need to maintain high penalties and interest for those who don't come forward during a period of voluntary compliance, as California is doing by excluding them from coming forward now in their general amnesty program. And we believe that there should be a broad publicity campaign, a campaign that lets not just people who might be likely to use these shelters to know about what's happening, but to let everybody in Oregon, everyone who passes the billboard on I-5 says something about, you know, we caught another guy, another family, another corporation, and they paid us $1 million. We are going after people who aren't pulling their fair share in our state. I think that's important. The friends I have and family I have in California have said they didn't really know this had happened in California. But it was in the San Jose Mercury and some of the national newspapers, it was not well publicized there. And I think that one of the powerful things about doing this is it's amnesty periods wake up the population to the fact that you're changing your enforcement standards. And that's a very important part of their role in taxation. And finally, when California enacted their legislation, they said they would take from promoters 50% of the gross that the promoter made in selling the tax shelter. I looked at that and went, wow, if I got $1 million for something and I only had to give $500,000 of it back, that still gives me $500,000 for advertising and promoting that tax shelter. So I think that Oregon should make it 100%. Now, since California acted, the IRS has acted, and they now impose a 50% penalty as well. So that's something you would need to consider. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Chairman Deckard, committee. My name, as I said before, is Del Devick. I'm a retired IRS audit team coordinator. What that means is that I audited large corporations toward the latter 18 years of my career. But the first nine I spent auditing businesses, small businesses, and individuals. Over the years, I think I became very, very familiar with the Internal Revenue Code, at least on the income tax side. And recently, I met Ms. Weiser, and she asked me to do an analysis of a report in Barron's, the business newspaper, in which it was reported that there was a tax gap of $311 billion, I believe. And she asked, you know, what is this? Is this abusive tax shelters? Is it corporations? Is it individuals? What is it? I said, you know, I've seen the same article, but let me take a look at it. So I started reviewing the news that's out there in the public sector. Most of it is at the IRS talking about the federal tax gap. And the standard reports or the definitions of a tax gap are that they are the difference between the amount of taxes collected and the amount of taxes due. Now, that could be attributable to a variety of factors. Could be attributable to delinquent taxes that we know about, tax liabilities of unknown filers, people who don't file. Could be due to taxes due for understatement of taxable income, which could give you a variety of causes, understated income, overstated expenses, false credits, deductions, whatever. The collective federal tax gap is based on historical audit data, and it's also extracted from census data in terms of the population. So it is not absolute, precise. I suspect that my wife, a statistician, if she were to take a look at this study, would say it's not statistically valid. But it's the only thing we've got. So in terms of the tax gap in Oregon, the available data published by IRS indicates that PIT, the IRS, annually fails to collect amounts equal to 20% or more of the taxes, income taxes, actually received. If we extend that percentage to Oregon's proposed state budget for the 2005-07 years, then I come up with an income tax gap of about $1 billion. Now, I would caution you that figure is subject to verification or trying to find all of that tax gap, but nevertheless, I would imagine that Oregon is not unique. It's not the only honest state in the union. So if there's a tax gap nationally, I think there's a tax gap in Oregon. Now, what I tried to do in my report here, there's Exhibit A, which incorporates a spreadsheet on which I used the federal tax collections that come from standard statistical reports in the economic report of the president, and I extracted the income taxes paid as well as payroll taxes. Payroll taxes don't enter into it specifically my analysis. Now, the tax gap amounts, now mind you, these are 2001 figures. The tax gap amounts came from Exhibit B, which is from the Taxpayers Advocate Service report to Congress for 2003. The Taxpayer Service Taxpayer Advocate Service is the ombudsman within the IRS. It's part of the IRS, but they're basically independent and separate. And I then compared that tax gap that they had in Exhibit B to the tax, income tax, actually collected to arrive at both the corporate and the individual income tax gap. Now, the Oregon tax gap is simply the federal percentage applied to the proposed Oregon budgeted revenues. And on it, I have, on the spreadsheet, I have captioned projected Oregon tax gap. These percentages are 19.74% of the individual income tax gap and 21.74% of the corporate income excise tax gap. The projected tax revenues for 2005 through 7 multiplied by the tax gap percent result in the aggregate annual $1 billion tax gap. Now, there are two ways of expressing the tax gap. $1 as a percent of $4 collected, or $1 as a percent of $5 that should be collected. For any of you who've ever been in the retail trade, think of 50% markup, or 50% gross profit, or 100% markup. Figures are different, but the amount's the same. So when we're playing with percentages and base, let's be sure we know what we're talking about. And there are contradictory or different ways of saying it.
So, Mr. Dierick, how much, if you, and I know this is somewhat of just a guesstimate, of that billion, if that is, in fact, the billion, and you've done a great deal of work on this, would you say is folks that are just legitimately in arrears, they are attempting to comply but just simply don't have the revenue to comply?
You mean you're saying that they have filed tax returns and they have declared the income but they haven't paid it?
Exactly.
I would not know what the data for Oregon is, but certainly the legislative revenue would, in terms of the receivables that are on the books.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We have an annual report, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. So, in any case, the estimates of the $311 billion of uncollected taxes have been made by Barron's. And furthermore, they project that there's a growth of the underground economy in 5.6. And I think Mr. Warner of the legislative staff would probably, if he hasn't read this article yet, it makes it's from, I believe, an economist who projects that the census figures that the federal government uses are not accurate in terms of making economic projections. In another book written by David K. Johnson, a New York Times investigative reporter who writes extensively on tax issues, he also quotes an estimate of $300 billion of uncollected taxes. Now, the sources of these estimates are the IRS reports, the same ones that I've made, which are made to and at the direction of Congress. And the latest is the annual report by the National Taxpayers Advocate Service, and it's dated December 2004, and it again quotes its own report in 2003 and in turn goes back to 2001 data. Now, during the past 2 years, the IRS has been engaged in the compliance measurement program managed by the National Research Office of the IRS. This data has not yet been published, but the old data, which I have here, is available. Now, we expect, I think this summer, the IRS will be coming out with their compliance data. That is the word. Now, another indication of a tax gap is the Multi-State Tax Commission, an association of state tax agencies, has published a study estimating the corporate income tax revenues which are not being paid to the states. In Oregon, for the year 2001, we're dealing with historical figures, okay, this amount was estimated at $80 million compared to the actual income tax collections of $323 million. I've got that particular exhibit from the report included as Exhibit C. Now, the MTC, the Multi-State Tax Commission, uses the term tax shelters instead of tax gap to characterize what I consider to be traditional tax avoidance and income shifting techniques and not the abuse of tax shelters that we heard about a little bit earlier. Oregon, fortunately, doesn't have the biggest corporate tax gap. The bigger states have greater gaps. But with states, I guess we call ourselves medium-sized, Oregon, as a percentage of the revenue in that particular report, has a 25% revenue loss, whereas Virginia has a 41% loss, Wisconsin 32, and Arizona 31. Alaska, I think, relies on a different kind of tax system, extraction taxes from natural resources, so they're not subject to that, so that's why they're zero. In any case, this means that in Oregon, an amount equal to 25% of the corporate income tax collection is not being reported and obviously not being paid. And again, the percentage could be computed in different ways. Now, one comment I want to make on the MTC report, that is large corporations. That's not your mom and pop business down the street. These are all large multi-state corporations. Okay, and it involves basically offshore issues, and I believe I've heard the term used here in legislative hearings of water's edge taxation. So part of that comes from that. Now, in terms of the historical data, GAO in 97 published a report that the individual and corporate tax gaps together amounted to 17% of the total potential tax liability, of which 4% was ultimately collected in subsequent years. But expressed as a percentage of tax collected, the tax gap is, again, above 20%. In 2003, in a paper authored by two IRS economists, a flowchart, which I've included as Exhibit D, shows the source and the amounts of noncompliance by type of taxpayer and the type of compliance failure. In other words, failure to file, failure to pay, or just basically showing a different figure on the bottom line of your tax return than there should be. The tax gap in 98 amounts again to more than 20% of the actual federal tax revenues for both individual and corporate income taxes, and almost 12% for social insurance or so-called employment taxes. And again, I've computed the percentage by reference to the amount collected. The categorization in this paper, I think, is helpful just in terms of giving a visual view of the problem on this particular exhibit. Now, what isn't included in the tax gap is something that we've talked about this morning, and that is the tax gap is primarily based on filed returns and on past audits, and the gap attributable to unfiled returns is an estimate based on the difference between census data and filed returns. In other words, if we have a census population of X amount and so many tax returns filed, a certain number of people are in our local housing state pen, I believe. They don't pay taxes. They don't file. We know that. We know people who are low-income, people who don't file, but a certain other percentage should file. So that's where that kind of data comes from. Now, the historical audit data may include audits or taxes from criminal activities, but generally the IRS doesn't go out of its way to audit criminals as such, although they do have organized crime units. Petty street crimes, I've never bothered in the time of going out and, you know, trying to audit a drug pusher or a petty burglar. So that's not part of the base. Now, the big money, okay, in terms of seizing money laundering operations, IRS has been involved with that, but unfortunately, customs and drug enforcement agencies always take the money. So, again, that drug revenue is not in the IRS tax gap. In 2003, in reports to Congress, the GAO, quoting the IRS, projected that non-compliance attributable to abuse of tax shelters could amount to about $33 billion. I've seen other figures recently, but these tax shelters in this category are categorized as abusive, and they're distinguishable from the garden variety or vanilla-type tax shelters described by the Multi-State Tax Commission, or things that we've known about, you know, that have been going on for way prior to my career. But the projections for the abuse of tax shelters are increasing as new tax shelters are identified. Now, the federal tax shelter noncompliance is not included in the earlier federal studies because, number one, the shelters were in litigation. They're currently being identified. So I don't think they're hitting the database. There could be some early cases where IRS litigated and they may have crept into the data, but I have a doubt. In conclusion, the tax gap outside of the abusive tax shelter area is large. It's growing. California legislature, as you heard, has enacted tax shelter legislation. The federal government, in its 2004 Act, has passed legislation penalizing participants and promoters. And the California Franchise Board has certainly taken some very publicized measures to seek out non-filers and non-reporters outside of the abusive area. Now, the IRS has also gone after tax shelters big time. They have taken their people in what's called the large and mid-sized business unit and started diverting many of them to the abusive tax shelter program. But guess what? They're no longer auditing the corporations. Now, that's basically reading between the lines of the footnote in the New York Times, plus some knowledge that I might have as an informed public citizen. But their resources are being diverted, so your over $10 million asset corporations going on up to the big, let's say $500 million or billion-dollar type asset corporations. A lot of those corporations probably aren't being covered unless George Bush tonight gives them a whole lot more money. And what this means is basically that if IRS is finding less non-compliance, and as a matter of fact, that's the suggestion of a November article in the New York Times, it's because they aren't looking. Right. So the end result is when some taxpayers are cutting corners, whether they be small taxpayers, corporations, individuals, big international corporations, a tax burden is shifted to people like Jody. So, or to people whose income is reported on W-2 1099, of which I mentioned a fair number of us are in that category. And so what the Department of Revenue has to do and the legislator has to support the Department of Revenue is to take steps that the tax burden is carried by all taxpayers, not just those who are caught up in the information reporting program or who have, let's say, high ethical standards. Mm-hmm. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Diebig, for making yourself available to us. You have a great deal of experience in this field. Just, Senator George, do you have any questions?
Very informative.
Just the one question that I have is based on your experience. It sounds to me that the California program was one, and I know Governor Schwarzenegger recently proposed, and I don't know if you're familiar with his most recent proposals, but has recently proposed, I guess, a new round of initiatives. But it sounds to me that is the one that, based on your experience, you see as one is, that is a possibility for modeling for Oregon.
I would say any action you take is going to be positive. The payoff isn't going to be as big. You can't devote the resources, but you should at least raise the flag to say that you're here, that you're doing something.
Great. Great. Appreciate your testimony. Thank you, Ms. Weiser. Mr. Mike Roach and Mr. Rick York. And apologize that we've taken, we scheduled an hour and a half and we've gone over, but that's a good thing because it's...
My testimony is pretty short. Chair Deckard and distinguished members of the Senate Revenue Committee. My name is Mike Roach. As a 27-year member of the National Federation of Independent Businesses and a 3-year member of the Oregon Business Association, I want to thank you for this opportunity to testify before you on the issue of tax fairness through better tax compliance. I come before you because I want to speak to the critical importance of maintaining a business environment where everyone pays his or her fair share of taxes. It's the obligation of government to see that it is so. I see taxes as the rent we pay for the business environment and infrastructure, from banking and transportation to public safety and an educated workforce, upon which our success as business people rests. 30 years ago this month, actually, my mother, Phyllis Roach, and I opened our store, Paloma Clothing, on a hope and a prayer that we could succeed against terrific odds. Prepared to work hard, but knowing we were very short on actual retail experience, we made our first conscious decision to seek help from the government when we sought out the services of the Service Corps of Retired Executives from the Small Business Administration. The SBA program was an early investment in us from the U.S. government, and Mr. Landauer, the former buyer for the Littman Wolf department store, with whom the SBA matched us. Mr. Landauer held our hands for the entire first year of our operation. His most memorable advice was delivered to us at the end of a particularly slow month in our first year in his not-so-slight German accent. Phyllis and Mike, you must understand that to be in retail, you must have nerves of steel. Mom and I never forgot his words, which we both took seriously and periodically laughed about. We cited him often, actually, in the course of our establishing our business. So 30 years later, we are a lucky and successful Paloma Clothing with 10 employees. We pay our federal, state, and local taxes, and I think of those taxes as back rent on the critical infrastructure that included Mr. Landauer, an infrastructure that helps us today just as it helped us survive back when we paid little or no tax because our profits were then so meager. Taxes are how we pay for the infrastructure that enables businesses to operate at a profit. We are really just renting a complex, interdependent system of public infrastructure, with public safety being among the most important components. If all businesses and individuals are not paying their fair rent, it leaves the rest of us paying still more rent or facing a deteriorating public infrastructure, both of which threaten small business survival. We're not afraid of our competitors, but we need to be confident that they are paying their taxes and not reaping an unfair advantage over those of us who do pay fully. Without strong compliance efforts, the knowledge that some store was recently audited or the experience of having one's own records checked, it's easy for cash businesses like our own to find excuses for not fully participating in the tax system. So I urge you to be bold in your efforts to recreate a much more level playing field on this critical issue of actual and perceived tax compliance. And I thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Roach. Mr. York.
Yeah, my name is Richard York, and I live in Portland. I've been doing some research on, for Jody's committee, on the various states that publish the names of delinquent taxpayers, otherwise known as public humiliation. Of course, this has become a lot easier with the World Wide Web. In a period when so many people are either unemployed or don't make enough to support their families, it is difficult to ask them to pay more in taxes. It is particularly hard when there are people who simply don't pay or even make arrangements to pay their taxes. People who don't pay their taxes or underpay are making it even harder on their fellow Oregonians. They're simply not playing by the rules that the rest of us follow. For the last 10 years, over a dozen states have been publicizing the names of delinquent taxpayers. Most of them now publish them on the World Wide Web, and they have specific sites. They have very catchy names such as Cyber Shame and Debtor's Corner, but they're all electronically published. Rather than go state by state, and that's why my testimony will be very short, I've listed them in a hard copy, and I've also given you my email address if you want an electronic copy, which has the links in it at the bottom of the second side. As of last April, when the article from which I took a lot of my information was written, public humiliation on the World Wide Web has helped states recover millions of dollars in overdue state taxes from both businesses and individuals. The most striking example is on the back, and it's Connecticut, which has gotten $161 million since it started 10 years ago, and in direct payments, and another $21 million in payment arrangements. So, I mean, we're looking at almost $18 million a year.
And do you know, Mr. York, is this state, the State Department of Revenue, or is this...
It's usually the Department of Revenue, because these, as you mentioned, there were some questions about violating privacy, and apparently delinquent taxpayers' names are publicly available anyway. If you and I were to go into the Department of Revenue, they maintain this list. What this does is put it up more boldly in front of the public.
And do they have a searchable database on there? Where
I have not been able to check with our own Department of Revenue, and I've made calls to a couple of it. When I first pulled this article up last week, I put calls in and sent emails to three of the bigger states that are doing it to ask them, you know, prior to this, what kind of information was available to the public and how did you get it?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, anybody who has a tax lien, that's a publicly available piece of information. It's required by law to publish the lien so that anybody else who happens to have a potential lien against that, you know, that taxpayer will know that the state has gotten one. Most states update their lists at least once a year, and some of them do it almost monthly, which was surprising to me. Anytime somebody tripped over a one-year or six-month boundary, they would automatically get posted up to the list. That may be the easiest way to do it. In conclusion, while gaining revenue for the state in a time when we really need it, one important consequence of such a program and the publicity attendant to it is that it helps to foster an atmosphere of compliance, which I think you've heard from the previous speakers, is declining pretty sharply.
Mm-hmm.
That's the extent of my testimony.
Really appreciate it. Really appreciate it, Mr. Roach. Questions for the panel?
I just think some of the debtor's corner and the yeah. net, these are pretty cute.
Well, we've got some great ad agencies here. And
that would be important. An incentive to get it done if your yeah. name was on that.
Yeah.
Well, Chair Deckard, in that line, could I just add that I think this amnesty program for individuals and businesses who may have been involved in abusive tax shelters, if part of the amnesty could be the ability to remain anonymous during the amnesty period, if they come clean, but boy, we're going with debtor's corner right after that. A business's goodwill, a small business owner's goodwill in the community is a huge asset. And it can work for you or it can work against you. And most businesses are smart enough to know how they want to play that one. So I think that could be a fairly huge incentive for the individuals who own their own businesses and operate with the public in particular. They might be very, very interested in taking the amnesty, maybe more for the goodwill saving than the tax penalties that they're going to avoid.
That's an excellent point. I'm going to lean on our staff here to get these get that one down and get the one down with the website. Because what we'll do, and thank you very much for all the time and effort I know that you've put into this and the research that your group has done, which is really helpful to us. What we'll do tomorrow is we might hear Senator George has perhaps a person to testify. We'll continue to do a little bit of public testimony.
Do we have one other person?
Oh, and we're going to hear from one other person. Mr. Gordon Hillisand. I hope I pronounced your name correctly. Thank you
very much.
So as Mr. Hillisand comes up, tomorrow will also be just a time for the committee to weigh the different proposals and discuss them and look at an omnibus bill to be drafted. Thank you very much. You're batting cleanup for us this morning.
My name's Gordon Hillisland, and I'll be as quick as I can, so if you'll have patience while I go through this and not say things, I would appreciate it. I was a revenue officer with the Internal Revenue Service for 16 years. That's a field tax collector. I watched the Internal Revenue Service go from a relatively efficient organization to a relatively inefficient organization purposefully. I'm going to tell you what I saw inside the Internal Revenue Service and what I see the Oregon Department of Revenue doing from the outside, and my conclusions will be that neither one has a high priority of creating revenue or bringing in revenue for the government entities, so that government entities have enough money. As was already said, the book Perfectly Legal is a good source, and Chapter 10, as far as I'm concerned, provides some very good information. When I was working for Internal Revenue Service, I found out about illegal tax protesters. Those are people who commit fraud to avoid payment of taxes. And without giving you the details, my personal estimate is that there are tens of thousands of people in Oregon who are illegal tax protesters who do not pay taxes because they commit fraud. And if you talk to field tax collectors in the Oregon Department of Revenue, they can tell you the geographical areas where these people are primarily located. I watched the Internal Revenue Service change rules internally to make it more difficult to bring in revenue for the government agencies. One they did for the audit group was to, instead of allowing an auditor to open an audit and follow whatever they wanted to follow within the audit and find fraud or mistakes or whatever and create revenue, they told the auditors they had to name the areas of the audit before they went in, and if they found fraud somewhere else, they could not pursue it. I knew a man in Portland who worked on a national task force trying to determine how leveraged buyouts avoided taxes. He finally found out, he told his superiors, and nothing was ever done. So they are they choose where they choose to pursue tax law enforcement, and leveraged buyouts was not one they chose to pursue. In collection, it used to be that a revenue officer could find a person who they thought might be avoiding taxes and look at records to see if they filed. They were prohibited from doing that. eventually. They've gotten to the point now where a revenue officer to work a case, instead of just showing up, they have to call the delinquent taxpayer and make an appointment. And if the delinquent taxpayer doesn't want to talk about it, then they are not allowed to pursue that particular person in many ways because they don't have the information or the or other aspects. But I wanted to compare this to a street cop in a local area. They've the way the Internal Revenue Service operates, instead of a revenue officer initiating a case, it has to come down from a central office. So if you can imagine a street cop driving down the street in his car, he can't punch in the license plate of the car in front of him to see if it's stolen. He's got to ask somebody at a central office for permission to do that. To me, that's highly inefficient, and they'd quit checking for stolen cars. Also, revenue officers were no longer allowed to talk to neighbors about people who just to see if they still lived at a particular place or where they worked or what their activities were. So if you can imagine a police officer investigating a crime who was not allowed to talk to their neighbors. And when I said we had to make an appointment to discuss cases, can you imagine a cop calling up a meth cook and say, excuse me, can I make an appointment to talk to you about your crime? And if he said no, then you couldn't go out there and do anything about it. And to me, it's the same thing.
Mr. Hillslam, we have to be on the floor in 2 minutes
okay,
at the Senate block.
Oh, that's good. You've heard enough. I would point out that there's a newspaper article on the back of my testimony that's very important.
Thank you. I think Senator George might have one question.
I was just going to say, I mean, who do we know in a police officer setting that might be actually looking at a person who just stole $1 billion?
There are some.
That's what I'm talking about. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you to the folks who made time to testify. We'll return to this topic both again tomorrow. Senator George, did you...
They prefer now to meet with us in private,
okay.
And we'll see if we can arrange that probably one or two of us at a time.
Perfect. Okay. So we'll do those meetings privately and then return to this tomorrow and then probably again next week, at least one day for the drafting or consideration of the bill. Thanks. We are adjourned.